Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 21. "How are you this morning, Mr. Domashev?" asked the young nurse with a small, shiny stainless steel tray covered in small white paper cups with various pills in them. "This one is yours," she said, holding it out for him to take. "I just woke up from the drugs you gave me last night. Why can't you bring me some coffee instead?" asked Boris. "Apologies, Mr. Domashev, but I'm just following orders," she said. "I know all about orders. I used to give them, and now I take them. But I am exercising my choice. I am not sick. I need no pills now. I want to know when I am free to go," he said with the old bureaucrat voice. He sat up on the edge of the bed and dropped his feet almost to the floor. "Where are my clothes?" he asked. "The doctor will be here shortly, and you can discuss it with him. When you came in yesterday, you needed sedation." "I'm so sorry. I cannot just let you leave," she said. "I will wait for your doctor, but I am not eating any pills. And what about some coffee?" he repeated. "I will bring you some coffee, but breakfast is also on the way shortly. Relax and behave, or I will give you a shot," said the nurse with a smile. Boris almost managed a smile in return, but it could not reach his face. He nodded a couple of times and swung his feet back up on the bed and reached back for his pillow, folding his hands under his head and leaning into it. The events of the previous days didn't belong in his life. He made his career out of bricks made with predictability. When bosses over him died or retired, he would move up the ladder. The empire was enormous, and there was never a plan for its demise because it had always been there. It was not enough to win, they used to say. All others must lose. When the American President Reagan demanded the wall in Berlin to come down, it was like the ground crumbled away under the giant's feet. It stumbled and fell hard on the rocks, shattering into dozens of small states. The Ukraine, an integral part of the Russian hierarchy since 1763, exerted its desire for independence, but could not outrun the oligarchs living in their mountain fortresses filled with gold and secrets beyond measure. Estonia, Crimea, and Kazakhstan all bolted for their own frontiers and exploited the wealth of natural resources and warm water access to the Black Sea. But as hard as they tried to become part of the global community, to try to join the Europeans as part of a capitalistic horse race, they were held back by lack of capital and closed borders. Getting a simple visa to cross those borders took weeks and would often still involve bribing consulate pukes a third his age. Still, there were small companies every day coming into the country, and they sometimes hired local people. It was a risky life, he did not understand. Private enterprise had no promise of a future. It was full of chance and periods of scarcity that were never part of a Russian bureaucrat's life. Now, he found himself alone and facing the prospect of no job. His beautiful Sasha was gone, along with his cat and his custom-made dress shoes. The drugs from the day before were lingering in his body, almost suppressing the rage that wanted to throw his bed out the window. His bare foot barely wiggled as the emotion tried to find a path out of him. There was emotion now a dozen beds down the hospital room that took up this corner of the building. They were nearly empty, except for him and three others who laid in their beds motionless under the inadequate fluorescent lights in the old building. The gray Almaty morning filtered through the plate glass windows, etched from decades of acid rain that washed the soot from three coal-fired power plants spaced over 50 miles of the long valley between the mountains to the south and the plains to the north that were covered in wheat and barley barely sprouting in the spring weather. "Mr. Domashev," said the old doctor, "I understand you wish to leave us already." Boris looked at him passively for a long moment as the doctor glanced at his chart and then back to him. "My life is my own," he said softly in the old Russian tongue. I'm not a psychologist, Mr. Domashev, but I know shock when I see it. It looks like you are a healthy man. I see in this report that you have had a heavy loss. Are you sure you are ready to go out to try to pick up the pieces? He replied in the same dialect. Da, he said, with the consonant sliding off the middle of his tongue. Why don't you relax and have some breakfast with us, began the doctor. And some coffee, said Boris, stepping on his thought. And some coffee, smiled the doctor. And then we will talk again midday, and we will negotiate. Be careful, doctor. I'm a very good negotiator, said Boris. I'm counting on it, Mr. Domashev, said the doctor as he placed his chart back on the hook at the end of his bed and turned to leave. I will have your clothes brought to you. They needed washing. Thank you, doctor, said Boris, taking his hands from behind his head. One more thing, if I may. Yes? My phone. Do you know where it might be? It should be in the drawer by your bed. Everything, except your uniform, is in there, said the doctor, trying not to be blunt. Not everything, doctor, said Boris, smiling professionally. The doctor turned away and began walking. He put his hands in his pockets as he walked and lowered his head slightly, knowing he couldn't fix everyone who was broken. Damn socialist medicine, he thought to himself. Boris waited until the doctor reached the end of the room and made the corner into the main hallway before sitting up on the edge of the bed and opening the drawer in the metal nightstand next to his bed. His phone, wallet, a belt hook with a few keys on it, and his fabric belt were inside. He picked up the phone and pushed the button to turn it on, but it remained dark. Perfect, he said under his breath. He slid his feet to the floor and stretched out the effects of the drugs from the previous day and wondered if cognac was ever considered for breakfast. His legs were stiff and sore, but he spread them a little and twisted his body one way and then the other. He turned to look out the window at the city, trying its best to sprinkle color here and there, assuring him spring was really on the way. Soon the apple trees and pear trees would be in bloom, and the pollen from the forests and the mountains would cover everything, and the evenings would turn warm. Life would begin to crawl forth from the Siberian winter and make its brief dash for prosperity. Boris, the male voice came from behind him. He jumped slightly and turned around to see his manager standing there in his FedEx uniform. That driver's uniform looks good on you, said Boris. Hey, I just made my deliveries downstairs and had to come up to see you. I lost you yesterday. By the time I got to your street, you were nowhere to be found. I don't know where to start, my friend, said his manager. Then don't. Please, comrade. I am alive and well. Take that burden from your heart, said Boris. I am glad for that. But the city has gone insane. It has been on the news non-stop since the attack. It was a car bomb, chattered his manager. I know. The detectives told me. You were right, my friend. I should have killed the son of a bitch, said Boris. That has not been good publicity for the company, Boris. They are saying that the bombing was repayment for attacking that man at the Tinkoff Club, he said. The police don't want this to escalate, and they're calling for calm, but they are adding men to the streets. It's not a good time, he said, moving close to him. I don't doubt that they want to feel safe, said Boris. I argued for a bereavement, and they granted it for you, he said. I am grateful, said Boris. You can stay at my place for a while. My wife will help you with the funeral and any other arrangements you need to make, he said. You don't have to do that. Yes, I do, he said with passion. More than you know, I need to do this. Please, my friend, he said, holding his right hand out for Boris to shake. Boris had many people call him friend before. For decades, they flattered him and promoted him and smiled at him. But he could feel their daggers near his back. Somehow, the look in his face and the tone of his voice made this time feel truthful. He reached out and gripped his hand. "I believe you. Friends should use both first names," he said in Russian. "Oscar," he said. "My name is Oscar Minkoff," he said, smiling at Boris. He was younger than Boris by at least 10 years. He had secretly learned from Boris for years, always looking good on his performance reviews because of his punctuality and efficiency. It didn't take long to see the power and honor in this man, and it felt good to be able to repay him with something other than the best FedEx could pay a driver. "I think they're going to let me out of here today. Don't let my route run late. I will wait for you in the reading park across the street when you are finished, promptly at 5 o'clock," he said, releasing Oscar's grip and smiling at him. "We'll be fine," he said, drawing on his best from inside his secret history. Boris watched Oscar walk his new purple FedEx tennis shoes to the exit. He turned to look back out at the street. He thought about going back to his apartment and picking through the rubble. He wondered if the police kept looters away and if his little safe was still there. He took a deep breath and tried to exhale smoothly. He put his hands on the cool window sill and put each thought into a separate room in his mind. He thought of different versions of the Tinkoff event, but the wound on his soul kept pumping blood out on the floor of his brain. "We have a different future for you, my friends," he said to the dingy glass in front of him. He laid back down on the bed and crossed his legs. Within a few minutes, he fell into a blessed, dreamless sleep. It was the only rest he could get from the advancing forces in his head. Mr. Domashev, said the nurse as she gently shook his bare foot. "What time is it?" he said before he opened his eyes. "It's nearly 3 o'clock. I have your clothes and some release papers for you," she said as she laid the folded FedEx uniform on the chair next to his bed. "There's a bathroom right over there," she said, pointing to the other end of the room. "Thank you," he said, rubbing his eyes. "I think I needed that rest." "How are you feeling?" she asked. "Much better." "What did you give me yesterday?" he asked. "Thorazine," she said. "Enough for a horse, I think," he said, sitting up on the edge of the bed. "I also brought you a cup of coffee. You missed breakfast." "I probably couldn't have eaten it anyway," he said as he took a sip of the coffee. It was hot, and he gently blew on the surface of it. At least the shaking inside had passed. He held the styrofoam cup in his right hand, pleased that he could hold it still. "Do you have someone coming for you?" she asked with a gentle concern on her voice. "My boss is coming," he said quietly. "I go on break in 5 minutes. I can take you downstairs to the cafeteria and get you something to eat," she said. "That's okay. I am sure I'm going to have a good dinner tonight. I've never eaten a hospital meal before. I am sure it is why I'm in such excellent health," he said, smiling slightly. "Promise me that will be forever true," she said, slightly understanding. "You take care of yourself." "I will. I promise," he said, standing up without a care that the back of his gown showed his bare white ass. She turned and walked away with a strange emptiness on her heart. It was sometimes a thankless job being a nurse, but it was good not to have anyone die on her shift today. Boris picked up his uniform and walked to the bathroom. Within a few minutes, he emerged with his shirt tucked in and his graying hair dampened and swept back off his forehead. He sat in the chair beside his bed and slipped his clean socks and purple tennis shoes on and laced them snugly. He smelled his jacket that smelled slightly of fabric softener and realized it was probably the first time it had been washed. He folded his release papers and slid them into the inside pocket of the jacket and draped it over his left arm. He stood up and walked out of the hospital, following the signs for the elevator. For the first time in his life, he walked out of the front door of the hospital and swore it would be his last. He walked slowly up to the corner, waited for the light, and crossed the street to the Reading Park. His blood chilled as he read the iron sign posted by the entrance. Veterans Park, dedicated to the soldiers who gave their lives in the Afghan War. It was a small corner park with apple trees and large hardwoods, just putting out the buds for their blooms that would beautify the downtown area for a brief week in a race to be pollinated before a frost might come and terminate the chance for spring fruit. He always saw people sitting on the benches and in the large gazebo reading or playing music in the summer. Locals just called it the Reading Park, mostly because no one wanted to remember veterans or why there would be a park dedicated to them by some politician who needed to be reelected. He found an empty bench with a view of the curb where there was street parking. He put on his jacket and sat down on the cold wrought iron and leaned back with his arms crossed. For some reason, he knew Oscar would arrive too soon. The grass was trimmed neatly around the walkways made of laid brick pavers. Birds dove from the iron archway at the entrance to the park and chased through the cool afternoon air, while robins jumped around the grass looking for worms and bugs to eat. He didn't move for a long time, letting the peace of this setting calm his soul. And he felt pleased that some bureaucrat on the corrupt city council might have actually had the thought that this would be a good place for a park. At first, the horn blended with the sound of the downtown traffic until he realized it was Oscar sitting in his car at the edge of the curb. He stood and walked to the car. Oscar had the passenger door window rolled down and said with a smile on his face, "Finished on time. If we hurry, supper will still be warm." Boris sat quietly and fastened his seatbelt. "I hope you like salted pork," he said. "My wife is an excellent cook." "Sounds like a good breakfast," he said. "My God, man, didn't they feed you in there?" he asked. "I missed it. Slept through it, actually," he said. They drove in silence for half an hour and turned up the long drive to what was an old farmhouse that had been absorbed by the sprawling city. The lights were on, and there were a couple of bikes on the front porch. Almost everyone in Almaty had some sort of bicycle. In the days of the Soviet Union, fuel was expensive, but reliable cars were practically unheard of. They parked the car in the gravel driveway and walked around the back door to the kitchen. "We're home," he said through the kitchen, inhaling through his nose. "Smells great." His wife walked in from the dining room with a flowered apron and short curly hair. Her face was round with German heritage and a broad smile. "It is so nice to meet you," she said, holding out both arms toward Boris. "I have heard so much about you," she said as she embraced him. "Oh, the pleasure is mine," he said. "Thank you for inviting me." "Are you kidding?" she asked. "I insisted that you take one of our spare bedrooms and stay as long as you like." "I called again about your bereavement. They promised to have a check ready by the end of the month," he said. "I am grateful to you. It's one thing less I have to think about," he said. Oscar grabbed a half-empty bottle of vodka from a shelf over the refrigerator, deftly picked up two tall, skinny shot glasses and placed them on the kitchen table. He poured them full and set the bottle down. "Here," he said, "try some of the salted pork." He picked two small strips of the meat from the plate by the stove and placed them on a small plate. "Hey, that's for dinner," his wife said, sharply slapping his behind. Boris and Oscar took a long smell of the pork, swallowed the vodka, exhaled through their mouths, and ate the pork before breathing through their mouths. "Kazakhs don't know how to drink vodka," said Oscar. Both men laughed, and Boris took off his jacket and hung it on the back of the chair. The next morning, Boris awoke to the smell of bacon and coffee. It was light already, which meant that Oscar had already left for work. He dressed and went downstairs to the kitchen to pour some coffee. "Oh, good morning, Boris," said Oscar's wife with a smile and a medium-sized mug of coffee offered to him. "Good morning," said Boris. "I checked with the coroner's office and the funeral home for you. They are ready to make arrangements for your wife. I also checked with the police about going through the property for salvage. They had a car there all night for the past 2 nights. It should be okay for you to go through your things," she said. "You have been very thorough." "Thank you," said Boris. "We only have one car. I am so sorry, but you can use one of the bikes on the porch if you like. And we have a friend with a truck if you need him to haul anything," she said. "That might be good. Could I have his number?" "Oh, and would you happen to have a phone charger for an iPhone?" asked Boris. "Oh, yes. FedEx standard issue," she smiled as she dug a charger out of the drawer in the kitchen. "Thanks," he said. "I have some bacon ready. I was waiting until you came down before I cooked some eggs and some toast. Would you like some?" "I would love some, thanks," he said as he sat down and plugged in the charger. The breakfast was delicious as Boris began to clear his mind for a new plan for his life. The radio was playing some local music in the background, and he sipped his coffee and waited for his phone to recharge. Suddenly, the broadcast was interrupted, and there was an unfamiliar tone that repeated 3 times. It was followed by a brief silence, and then a man's voice began to speak. "The following is a message from the President of the United States." There was a period of silence, and it sounded like there were papers moving in the background. This was an English-speaking radio station, mostly because they had the better music, but that was fine with Boris. "Good morning," began President Riker. "Normally, I would address this speech to my fellow Americans, but these words are currently being broadcast as close to live as possible to every people on the earth. They may be difficult words to hear, but I suggest you listen carefully, for they affect every one of you. As you may know, the planet is undergoing increasing levels of upheaval. In the coming days, there will be multiple volcanoes erupting simultaneously around the world. There will be intense earthquakes, one after the other, and the ocean itself may react with violent tsunamis and even whirlpools opening in the deeper parts of the water. This is all part of the union of the polarity as the two phases of the planet come apart. You may have also noticed that the people have become divided in their thoughts. What I mean to say is that there are those who are driven by jealousy and lust, even still, and they seem to be intensifying their lust for power. But I assure you, there is no power of this kind that will reward you. The rest of humanity is merciful and loving and full of charity, and there is no need for governments to compel them to give of their substance to the poor and needy. In the coming weeks ahead, we have good reason to believe that the dark forces of the earth may try to wage war with everyone else. The United States is doing everything within its power to see that these efforts fail. It is no longer a time to hate. It is a time to heal and to forgive. It is time to draw together as a people and get ready for this transition. Please, take the time each day to reflect on these things and contribute to the conscious energy of the planet by extending good thoughts toward your fellow man. That being said, there are also dark forces gathering. They are full of rage, battle-hardened, and will fight to disrupt the peace and instill terror in all mankind. Against this darkness, I am asking all within the sound of my voice to resist with every fiber of your being. If it is possible to save an individual from this darkness, by all means do so. But be prepared as well to deliver that person to his salvation if he persists in your destruction. There is no time for innocent victims anymore. We shall not accept terror as a method for forcing governments or religions to comply with their demands, and such states that engage in these tactics shall be swiftly removed from the face of the earth. We need all the innocent people we can find to gather strength and seek out the good in all people and help it to grow. Again, this is President Robert Ryker, and I endorse this message to all the people of Earth. The radio went silent for a moment, and then the series of annoying tones repeated. The music resumed from the local radio source, and Boris sat for a moment while the president's words sank in. His heart was calm now. He could feel the love he had for his Sasha, and he knew there was something he could do, something that he was uniquely prepared for because of his life. He walked out to the front porch and gently grabbed the handles to one of the bikes and walked it down to the gravel driveway. Within a few minutes, he was breathing deeply as he pedaled the bike through the streets of Almaty toward the site of his previous residence. He rummaged through the wreckage of his home and found the small safe buried in the corner of the garage where it had fallen through the burning floor. He looked for his shoes, but they were gone. There were a few pairs of colored shoes here and there from the large collection his Sasha had collected over the years, attending fancy state dinners and meetings with the Energy Bureau. He couldn't cry. Those memories were his, and no one could rob him again. He felt the peace of a hunter who is comfortable in his blind. The path before him had no signs. It was a wilderness before him. But he had had a hunch. The door had slammed hard, but there was a slight crack under the window sash. Again, in the darkness of the unknown, was a tiny sliver of light. The afternoon came and went as he stacked the things he could take from the wreckage of the blast. There was less than a truckload, for sure. He found some small ratchet straps in the rubble of the garage beneath his apartment. He hefted the small safe and placed it on the rack behind his seat and strapped it to the bike. When he was sure he could balance it, he rode back to Oscar's house. Oscar's car was in the driveway when he arrived, and he placed the bike back on the porch and unstrapped his small safe. He knew there was enough in it to help get some things done, like the funeral and some clothing. He wondered about what he was going to do for employment, but the thought wouldn't stay in his mind. "Good to see you, Boris," said Oscar as he cracked the front door. Boris didn't answer. He couldn't find words at the moment. He hadn't spoken all day, and to do so now was so far from reality that he simply looked at Oscar and managed a small smile. "Supper's almost ready. Why don't you come in and join us? You probably haven't eaten all day." "No, I ate a little something, but I will join you," said Boris finally. "Want to play some cards later?" asked Oscar. "No, I have somewhere I have to be," said Boris. "Really? Can I give you a lift?" "Sure. I won't be leaving for a couple of hours, but that will be fine. You can drop me off," said Boris. "No problem. Where are you going?" asked Oscar. "The Tinkoff," said Boris, as he picked up the safe and walked through the door past Oscar and up to the stairs leading to his room. "I'll be back down in a minute or two."